All action on this plane springs from desire of some sort, and it has been said that desire and will are the same. Perhaps they are. It has also been said that desire relates to the temporary, and that will is some kind of superior motive force, but I should be inclined to say that will in its more dignified phases was merely desire for a higher thing, that is, if I wanted to separate the two. Music may be sublime and music may be ragtime, it is still music. The force of the wind may fan the flame that burns your house, or it may fill the sails of the boat that takes you across the sea to your soul's desire. It is still the same wind. You may even desire to desire the higher things. You may will to will with the law instead of against it. Is that not desire, too? In advising you not to feed by blood sacrifices the elemental forces in yourself which crave that impure food, I am not inviting you to kill out desire. You will have to desire to purify your system from the material of dead animals before you will willfully cease to feed on them. The evil in you, the hungry fiery selfish nature, sucks up the blood that passes your lips somewhat as the evil beings above the battlefields suck up the blood that flows from the wounds of the fallen. If you have no further use for these creatures, you can cease to feed them with blood. You will never kill out your emotional nature by ceasing to eat meat. You will merely purify it. The whole soul world is a world of emotion, and the pure beings of the elements are very emotional, but they do not feed on blood. Yes, mind is higher than emotion, it is beyond emotion. You can have mind without emotion, and you can have emotion without mind to any great degree, as in the animals, but man is made of both. He is dependent on his middle register, his soul desire nature, in order to work in the soul world as a growing entity there. When you reach the highest heaven you will be living in thought with only so much of the desire nature as you have raised with you by memory and assimilation. You can raise more of soul dynamics into the highest region if you do not clog your feet on the road by desire for bloody food. Leave that to the demons who gorge themselves on the battlefields. During the reign of brotherhood which I am trying to help in bringing about, the race will subsist on a pure diet. Even now there is a tendency toward the elimination of dead animals from the dietary. The desires of the new race will have to be purified, their emotions raised and intensified. The emotions of a man are much more intense than the emotions of a lion. The emotions of a god are cosmic. April 16th. Letter 24, The Scales of Justice. Lest anyone should think that in working for brotherhood I am either knowingly or inadvertently striving to bring about a state of lax acquiescence in the wrongs committed by my fellow men, by my brothers, I want to talk about justice. As one who has been a so-called judge in a court of justice, I have had some little experience in the practical working out of a balance between mercy and severity. Justice is one of the gods that I have always placed high in my personal pantheon, and never in handing down a decision did I, through weakness or sentimentality, hamper the right of the good in order to pander to the wrong of evil. I had given mild judgments when most good seemed to be promised that way, I had given severe judgments when it seemed to me that evil would be best curbed that way. Much nonsense has been talked and written about universal brotherhood, as about most of the other ideals of mankind. Universal brotherhood is not universal acquiescence in evil, it is universal acceptance of the ideal of good. And you will never have a brotherhood worthy of the name until you raise, not lower, the standard of justice. Justice is balance, justice is equilibrium between forces, justice is poise. It is because I hope to see a more poised humanity that I am urging men to concentrate upon love instead of upon hate. Since I have been stationed in Europe and in the immediate neighborhood of the Western battlefields, I have helped hundreds of souls to help themselves through the terrible astral conditions into which a sudden and premature dropping of their physical bodies has precipitated them, but in no case have I tried to upset the balance between cause and effect by helping a soul to a freedom for which it was not prepared. I have let men suffer when I could have shortened their suffering. I have let many souls work out in the astral world a slow battle with their lower desires, because I knew that if they were plucked from the tree of pain before they were ripe, They would have to go through it all anyway and battle harder in another life with those very forces which now by their suffering they were severing in the region where, from the very limitation of satisfactions, elementary desires are more easily starved out than on the earth. There was in one of the armies a very cruel officer who was hated by his men. He came out here and many of the men came out here, and I made no attempt to protect him from their reproaches, because he needed to learn that injustice deserves reproach. On earth their mouths had been stopped by army discipline, but out here he had to realize how much he had wronged them. He could never have realized it in any other way. Had I preached to him, he would have told me to mind my own business. The law of justice does not preach. It demonstrates. He had to endure demonstration of his own injustice through the dark and reproachful shadows by which he was long surrounded. And I may say in passing that he is still surrounded by them. I have made no effort to help him. Perhaps I could have done so, but such determined opposition on my part to the law of justice might have let him go forward into his own selfish heaven with such a load of injustice on his soul that in his next earthly life he would have been crushed by it. The resentment of these men was very deep, and while I might have softened it for their sake, not his, I let it work itself out. Had there been no one else needing my help and deserving it more, I might have spent a long time with these men and yet made little impression. I did exactly as I should have done on earth had such a case come before me, and I believed that I did it right. Whenever I see a soul afflicted by the unjust judgments of others, I seek to set the balance true, as I should have done on earth, but I am not here to upset the law of cause and effect. When I can help, I help. But I am more useful in preventing the setting up of evil causes than I could ever be in deflecting the legitimate course of effects. When I urge men to help the masters in holding back the awful karma of Germany, I am not talking sentimentally. I am talking as a just judge. The German people have been deceived by their leaders and have followed blindly a course they have not understood. Collectively they are responsible to the other races, but individually they are not responsible in the same degree, for they have been themselves deceived, and they do not know that their cause of national aggression is unjust and of satanic origin. It is the hope of those teachers who can watch from the outside and above, that the docile German people should not be forever hated by the world because the arrogant war party has hurled them at their neighbors. I am not condoning the unlovely traits in the German character, or in the character of any other people. But of all the races engaged in this gigantic struggle, the German race knows least about the causes that hurled it forward. A spoon-fed press and the penalties of lèse majesté have kept them from knowing anything which could have made them less flexible instruments in the hands of their leaders. The karma of those whose headstrong and arrogant policy precipitated this war is an individual karma, and it will have to be worked out by individual suffering and so-called punishment. But the karma of the great mass of the German people is a race karma. They have let themselves be led on to their own defeat. Think how the very law of reaction will throw the light of popular and democratic investigation into the darkest nooks and crannies of the German nation and government after this war. Those who have been deceived to their hurt will demand to be deceived no more. In 20 years the life of the German government will be as open as that of the United States. The so-called muckraker will arise with a lantern on his hat. Also by the law of reaction England will be shaken out of her sluggishness that has filled her shops with the wares of other countries because she was too slack to make her own. By that same law demand will arise for an uncorrupt political machine in France. One or two things have happened in France which she prefers for the moment to keep to herself. The great shock of this war will cause each nation to examine itself more closely, to look into its own motives, to see wherein it fails to come up to the very exigent standard demanded by the new time. Look also for changes in Russia, and Austria will be but another name for change. Justice will advance many paces by reason of the great injustice of this war. The law of opposites again. Most things can be explained by that law. In writing about the reign of brotherhood which I hope to see established in the world, I am not laboring under the delusion that an impossible utopia is about to be ushered in with a blare of trumpets. I am not recording a prophecy that the kingdom of heaven is immediately at hand. The human race is not ready for the kingdom of heaven, and will not be ready for a long time, but if one person in 10 can be made to realize that brotherhood is an ideal to be striven for, they can leaven the other 9/10 and make the loaf of human society much lighter and more palatable than it is at present. The loaf will not become fruit cake all at once. That is too much to expect of the next race, but if you can carry the memory of this prophecy through a sufficient number of births and deaths, you may see a very sweet loaf come from the planetary oven when the second race following, the 7th, is brought forth into the light of the sun. April 17th. Letter 25, For Love's Sake. So serious and philosophical have been my last few letters, that I should like to revel in romance. Have you thought of the hard life of the war nurses and wondered from whence they gather the strength for their daily and nightly labors? Love is the source of the almost superhuman endurance of many of the women who seem to their charges like angels of light and healing. One nurse whom we will call Mary, for she is a type of the Virgin Mother of Hearts, has gone out into heaven 100 times in the souls of those she has tended. Will that love not guard her on earth through the whole course of her life and follow her also into the heaven world beyond? Be sure it will. Mary is neither a scholar nor a poet. You would not have dreamed of inviting her to a reception had her path ever crossed yours, but Mary is not unfit for the society of angels and gods would not scorn to have her in their company. She was just an ordinary nurse before she became a war nurse, and before the white fire of love touched her personality and burned it up as a sacrifice on the altar of her country's need. She was a very pretty nurse and in her hours of leisure once wore stylish hats and reveled in laces and furbelows, for the love of beauty and daintiness often nests in a heart that is capable of heroism. When the war broke out, Mary was engaged to be married to a soldier. Mary went to the front and he also went to the front, but neither of them knew where the other was for many, many days. Every man who was brought to her severely wounded Mary nursed as if he had been the absent friend of her heart, and many a life she saved by her tender care and by the atmosphere of help which radiated from her as fragrance from a rose. If he should be wounded, she said to herself, some of the girls will care for him as I care for these men. Mary was not jealous lest another should have the privilege of nursing the man she loved, and lest in his heart should blossom a flower of thankfulness for another than herself. Mary had not much time to think about herself, her thoughts were too busy with others. It may have been because she was not jealous nor overwatchful for her property in her lover, that when he was wounded he was really brought to the hospital where she served so faithfully. Of course he was given to Mary to nurse, it could not have been otherwise, and he was very seriously wounded. When the operation was performed by which the doctors hoped to save his life, it was Mary who stood by and assisted. She did not faint nor cry out even when they cut his broken arm away, the arm on which she had dreamed she might lean for the rest of her earthly life. Mary was thinking about his mother and was glad that she was not there to see what she herself saw. During many of the hours when Mary might have slept, she was writing to the mother, writing brave letters wherein she sought to veil the fear that was in her own heart. Tom, we will call him Tom because that was not his name, Tom had never been able to believe in any life beyond the earth life, and as Mary watched his strength grow less she prayed all day and most of the night that something might happen to make Tom believe in heaven and angels. The exigencies of war had left him long on the battlefield after the shell had shattered his right arm, and his wound had been infected before the operation by which the doctors sought to save him for England and for Mary. Tom knew that he might have to leave the world. Mary would not keep the overwhelming possibility from him, though she still kept it from his mother, for she hoped that in the hours or days which might be all that remained for him in the sunshine of the upper world something might happen, some miracle of thought or of love, which should open his eyes to what she called the truth. Each day I spent a little time in the long white room in which Tom lay, but even if he could have seen me, I might not have been much comfort to him, and I cannot speak to any ears except those trained to listen for unusual sounds. I sympathized with Mary. Having convinced so many souls of the truth of immortality through a former writing of mine, I wanted to convince one more, for Mary's sake, because I knew that if Tom should go out of life firmly believing that death was the end of him, it might really be the end of him for a long time. In my perplexity, I sought the beautiful being for advice. That angel's knowledge compared to mine is like an arc light beside a tallow dip. Together we went back to the hospital where Mary sat talking with Tom about the future life, about God and Christ and angels. She had many soldiers under her charge, but the other nurses worked a little harder to give her more time with Tom, for all the world loves a lover, especially in the horrors of wartime. "It isn't that I do not want to believe," he was saying to Mary, "it's that I just can't. If I could see with my own eyes an angel, or someone that I knew was dead, it would be different. But how could I see such a thing?" The beautiful being drew nearer, smiling, and waved its gauzy veil before the eyes of the dying man, but he could not see. The beautiful being wove a glamour of light around him, and sang as only angels can. But Tom could still neither see nor hear. "I think you will have to materialize," the beautiful being said to me, with a whimsical smile. "Those eyes are stopped with matter, and cannot see anything finer than matter." I was not attracted by the suggestion, but my incomprehensible friend followed it up. "In that bed yonder," it said, "is one of those mortals who are called natural mediums, natural materializing mediums, because their tenuous bodies are so loosely held by the physical that they are easily detached and borrowed from. Now materialize yourself and let Tom see something which he will take for an angel." "I am no angel," I said, "and the eyes of a dying atheist would never mistake me for one." "Try it and see," said the beautiful being, pointing to a man in a neighboring bed, who was the medium in question. I looked at the man and read around him the story of his life. He was a coarse fellow, a saloon keeper, and another familiar compound word would have fitted him like a glove. "Clothe myself in that man's etheric body," I said in disgust. "I would not touch him with a 10-foot pole." "How dainty fingered you are," said the beautiful being. "Did I not know you so well, I could almost believe you self-righteous." "Call me what you like," I replied, "but I will not do phenomena with that body." The beautiful being laughed. "It would be so easy," it said, as if to itself, "so easy and so convincing." The angel moved toward the sleeping saloon keeper. I had almost written the harsher compound, and gradually from his side there issued a vaporous stream. From force of earthly habit I rubbed my eyes, for I could not believe that I saw aright. The pure and exquisite angel was clothing itself in the unhealthy emanations of the sleeping medium, and in the space of 20 ticks of the clock on the wall it passed, fully materialized, with a speaking throat, to the foot of Tom's bed. He sat up, in the surprise and shock of the vision. "What are you?" he asked, hoarsely. "I am an angel," said the beautiful being, "truly, and I have come to prove to you that miracles can happen, and to assure you that when you leave your body behind on the morrow I shall meet you on the other side of the change." Mary could also hear and see, and she fell on her knees with a little sob of joy and wonder, for she had never seen an angel, though her faith was strong enough to remove mountains. "Then it is really true," Tom gasped. "I shall not die with my body. And how wonderful you are!" For the beautiful being had performed the transformation so well that it preserved in its borrowed body all the glory and amazing loveliness of that form which charms the hosts of the unseen world. "I no longer doubt," said Tom. "I believe, and I die happy." "I shall not forget to meet you when you come out," smiled my friend. "Goodbye now, for a little while. I leave you with Mary, who is also a kind of angel." Slowly the borrowed shape retreated towards the body of the sleeping saloon keeper, and after a moment my friend stood beside me, clothed in its own pure form, but on its shoulders and feet were dark stains that looked like mud. "They will soon blow away in the fresh air outside," smiled the beautiful being. And was it not worthwhile to convince that soul of its own immortality? We passed out under the stars, but the scene left an indelible impression on my consciousness. And I shall often remember when I feel self-righteous, how the purest being I ever knew wore the soiled garment of a vulgar saloon keeper, which left stains on its dainty shoulders and its shining feet, how it dipped itself for the first time in the filth of the world, for love's sake. April 17th. Letter 26, A Master of Mind. Tonight, the 17th of April, 1915, the passed along the battle line of one of the nations at war a great spiritual being, a being whose body is mind and who works through the mind alone. The hour had come when a certain number of those who had fought bravely for their ill-starred country might know that their cause was hopelessly lost. A few only might know tonight, but their knowledge will spread, and with spreading knowledge will come a change of spirit. It is disheartening to fight on for a lost cause. It takes a peculiar quality of devotion, a rare quality of devotion. What will come from the visit of that celestial being, you wonder? Wait and see. I rarely permit myself to prophesy. I only figure out the probable result of causes known to me. You can do the same, if you let reason take the place of predilection. To judge clearly of the effects of a given cause, the mind must be unbiased by desire, it must be as cold as a mathematical calculation. It is by this celestial algebra that masters look ahead. When you get in symbols or pictures the answers to questions propounded by your higher self, it is by this profounder mathematics that the interior one prepares its answer. It knows causes that are unknown to you, and from these causes can foretell effects with a degree of accuracy almost as great as that of an astronomer foretelling an eclipse. Almost, I say, not quite, for in dealing with human affairs even the greatest masters must take into consideration an erratic element, the free will in human beings. That, too, may be guessed. But it is guessing, nevertheless. A sudden uprush of free and erratic will, and a new cause is set up, and the calculation must be made afresh. There is a certain charm in dealing with the erratic element of will. Perhaps that is why some persons find cats more fascinating than dogs. A cat is a willful erratic animal, so are many men. The great being who passed this night along the battle line has been watching the course of earthly events for a considerable time. He is one of those who serve the planetary spirit of the earth by carrying certain ideas around the earth when the time has come for them to play their part in history. I cannot tell you many details about the life of this being, for I know only a few facts concerning him. He is so far superior to me that my possible comprehension of him is limited. He may once have been a man, I think so, but of that I am not even sure. I have been told that it was he who first impressed upon a small but courageous section of American people the conviction that the time had come when human slavery in America should cease, that it was he who inspired Columbus with the idea that he could find land by sailing west, though in the latter case he was not able to force through into the mind of his instrument the great fact that an immense and independent continent lay off the beyond the western sea, and between it and another sea whose waters washed the eastern shores of Asia. Again, I have been told that it was this being who was instrumental in revealing the knowledge of electricity to mankind. Can you imagine the life of such a being? Can you extend your consciousness so as to touch his? I am frank enough to say that it is difficult even for me, who have been able to remember so much of my own long past, and to work out so many of the probable effects of the causes which I myself set up in the far past, effects which will shape my future lives on Earth. Imagine an independent entity of vivid life, yet without a physical or even an astral body, a being of thought whose lowest medium is thought, who influences his chosen instruments by contact with their naked minds. What personal wishes can such a being have? What ambitions can he have? The lower and limiting word ambition seems grotesque as characterizing the motive force of such a being. He has a name among us, but I am not permitted to tell you the name. It has a great mantramic value, that name, and if you should repeat it too often it might raise your own consciousness, and the vibration of yourself, to a height which would make it extremely difficult for you to keep your hold on that physical body, without which you cannot do certain work that it is your privilege and duty to perform at this stage of your evolution. There is a certain initiation which the pupils of the great masters take under the guidance of this being, but those who take that initiation retire permanently from the everyday life of men. They get into the center of causes, which make them so dynamic, which makes their personality and their thoughts so forceful, that for the sake of the world itself they must not come too close to it, because all things work by cyclic law, and to hasten too much the evolution of humanity would be dangerous to humanity. It can only go safely at a certain rate of speed. Above that speed it is likely to meet with accident. I know exactly the stage that I myself must reach before I can take the initiation which is presided over by this being. When I have reached that stage, I shall not be able to come and write through your hand, unless you raise yourself a corresponding degree above your present consciousness, because to do so might dangerously accelerate your own rate of growth. Since coming out here, I have learned much about those beings who have in charge the higher evolution of mankind. Their development would be quite incomprehensible to the mass of even enlightened men at the present time. They are and must be very lonely beings, though they too have their peers and fellow workers. Can you imagine remaining alone 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 years, yet all the time extremely active in mind, following with your thought the course of an evolution which you yourself have long left behind in your own growth, following it with the mind alone, because the emotional nature you have also left behind, and doing all this not for any personal reward but because it is a labor in accordance with the great law of a being still above and beyond yourself? Obedience is taught in certain schools, not in an effort to control the pupil in the interest of the master, but that the pupil may thus take his first steps on the path which leads to obedience to the cosmic will. On that path he will have to go an immense distance before he can be trusted to do such work as is being done by the being who passed this night along the battle line of one of the opposing armies, shedding the light of his thought and the certainty of his purpose into a few minds whose receptivity made possible their grasping what he gave. Do not weary on the path, you who are taking the first and easiest steps of the journey that shall one day lead you to the masters. The path is indeed steep, and as one inspired writer said, it leads uphill all the way, but there are stages at which the traveler may pause and enjoy the prospect. I seem to have reached such a stage myself, and though I am always working now, yet I enjoy my work. The awful battle that some of us fought with the elemental beings is now over. The worst calamity that could have befallen mankind is happily averted. The labor of the present is light compared with the labor of that struggle. If the world could realize what it owes to the masters whom most men regard as myths. But such teachers do not work for gratitude nor for reward. Follow you in their footsteps, for it is the only road that can lead mankind above the awful calamities that threatened recently to engulf mankind. I am not referring to a mere German victory. It is wise to keep from the knowledge of men in general the great evolutionary facts which govern the life of the planet. A mind must be lifted above the small circle of everyday interests before it could endure such knowledge. You all use words without realizing their meaning. You talk of guardian angels, you talk of hell and purgatory, and of vicarious atonement, and of sacraments. Sacraments. I could tell you of a sacrament that is verily an eating of the body and a drinking of the blood of God, but I refrain lest you should tell the world, and if you should tell the world the evil forces of the world would destroy you. But I am coming now perilously near the things that may not be spoken, so I will wish you a good night indeed, and go back to my labors, in the rear of that being of light who passed along the battlefields this evening. April 17th. Letter 27, Invisible Enemies. You may have wondered why the elemental beings that, as I have told you, precipitated the great war were so malicious at this time, why they hurled themselves upon mankind with such overwhelming force. There is no reason why you should not know something of these causes, having seen so much of their effects. The saying that man has made more material progress in the last 100 years than in the preceding 2000. Has become a mere newspaper commonplace. It is because he has not made a corresponding moral progress that the evil elemental beings, who fear for their rule in their own kingdom, could come so near to succeeding in their attacks upon the human race. It is not merely in material ways that man has progressed with such amazing rapidity, for some of his inventions and discoveries touch the invisible regions.